It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Topping the news right now, Washington State's Attorney General is the first in the country to announce a legal action against the Trump administration over one of its policies. Attorney General Bob Ferguson is suing President Trump over his executive order that suspended immigration from 7 countries with majority Muslim populations. That order sparked protests at SeaTac Airport and downtown Seattle and across the United States. Here's one example of people affected by Trump's action. The Al-Halabi family in Tukwila was supposed to be having a reunion today. They're Syrian refugees, and 2 of their older children, who are still in Turkey, were set to fly here today. One of them is almost 7 months pregnant. KUOW's Liz Jones reports the immigration ban means they're separated indefinitely.
The Al-Halabi family recently moved to a bigger apartment in Tukwila to make room for the new arrivals.
My daughter, Jaida. My son, Waleed. Husband, daughter, Abdul Malik.
That's Imtithal Al-Halabi, the family matriarch. She's on a video chat with her daughter, Jada, when I arrive. Jada is at her apartment in Turkey. You can see an Arabic-English dictionary on the table. Her husband is at her side. Their baby is due in April. It's the first grandchild for this family. Everyone's trying to put on a hopeful face, and the effort shows. But the youngest daughter, Ala, is a spark of distraction. She's 11 and boldly points to my camera and wants a turn.
Here, let's take a picture of your brother.
If you point it, this?
Yeah.
Her 19-year-old brother hams it up, flexing his muscles.
So strong. Yeah, it's good.
The Al-Halabi family came here as a family of 4, mom, dad, and 2 younger kids. They're pretty new to Seattle.
1 month and 17 days.
1 month, 17 days.
Yeah.
You know the days.
Of course, Imtithal knows exactly how long it's been since she said goodbye to her other children. Her husband, Ahmed, says he was worried whether his 2 older kids would make it here, even before the president's executive order. A family friend interprets for him.
I didn't want to get ahead of myself and start preparing for the baby. And a lot of people offered to bring us a crib and baby equipment. And I said, well, these things come quickly and come easy. I just want to wait for my daughter to come here first, and then I'll be reassured.
Trump's directive ends the Syrian refugee resettlement program in the U.S. immediately and indefinitely. It also suspends all refugee admissions for 4 months and imposes a 90-day ban on travelers from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Many Democratic politicians denounce the order as religious bigotry. Many Republicans defend it as a necessary measure for national security. Politics aside, this father, Ahmad Al-Halabi, has a personal message for Donald Trump.
I respect his decision that he wants to protect his country, and I respect his order. But I want to say that we are a peaceful people. We just want to live in a safe place as one family.
This family fled their home in Aleppo and the devastation there a few years ago. The children missed school, and in Turkey, they found odd jobs to make ends meet, from restaurant work to cell phone repairs. Around 200 Syrian refugees have been resettled in Washington state since the conflict started there. Imtithal says she tries to stay strong for her kids, tell them they'll be together again, things will get better. But when she talks about this baby girl on the way, her first grandchild, it hurts. Even without understanding any Arabic, you can clearly hear one word our languages share.
Baby.
Baby. For this family, seeing the massive turnout of support these last few days, with crowds in Seattle and around the country, they say they feel welcome and at home. Ala, the 11-year-old amateur photographer, nods in agreement.
It's good, but if my siblings come here, it will be better and better.
At least for now, there's no clear path for that to happen. In Tukwila, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
You can see photos of the Al-Halabi family, including some taken by that budding photographer, Allah. That's at KUOW.org. Now, on the record, we want to help you understand the bigger picture here of the president's new immigration order. So, KUOW's immigration reporter Liz Jones is back with us. Hi again, Liz.
Hello, Bill.
First of all, a sense of scale, please. Roughly how many people in the Puget Sound area are in some kind of limbo like the Al-Halabis?
Well, the limbo might be different for different people, right? But we know, say Syrians, for example, it's a small community. We know about 230 have been resettled here since the conflict started there in 2012. But more broadly, looking at the list of seven countries that have been restricted by this executive order, seven predominantly Muslim countries, in King County, that's a population of about 20,000 people who were born in those countries. Or King County, rather, is 15,000. In Washington State, it's about 20,000 people. So this order affects refugees and immigrants alike. Refugee resettlement in Washington State tends to be about 3,000 people per year. Refugees resettlement is on hold here right now. So of those 3,000 resettled here every year, it's safe to say they all have family overseas they were hoping would probably join them here someday. That's all on hold right now. Cases we've heard about, it affects not just refugees, immigrants coming here seeking safety or seeking freedom from persecution or religious persecution and war, but also people who are coming here to study as students. I heard from an Iraqi woman who's a Fulbright scholar here at the UW. She's a pediatrician, and she was about to buy a ticket for her mom to come for her graduation. The woman here, the Iraqi here, she's in asylum. She's here on asylum, and she can't go back to Iraq. If she does, she has to live in hiding. So she said, I have to choose between my mom and my future. In Iraq, I have no career. Here, I can't have my mom. So it's affecting people in all kinds of different ways. One of our reporters, Kate Walters, was at SeaTac this morning and talked to an Iraqi family who was also waiting for their loved ones to come in who had been visiting a sick relative in Iraq.
Like the last 2 days, it was terrible for us. We didn't sleep, we didn't eat. Here, my little brother always crying. And if we could cry, we will cry, but we can't because we have to be that strong in the family, because we're older. I don't know what to say, but it was really, really terrible.
So there are people right now that aren't sure if relatives overseas are going to be able to come and join them. People at the airport here waiting and watching to see what might happen.
Now, today's news, as I mentioned, is that Washington State's attorney general is the first in the country to announce that he's suing President Trump over this immigration order. On what basis is he suing?
Yeah, so this big news coming out just now, and we're just still getting all the details in. But it looks like the basis is challenging some key aspects of this immigration order, and this would be nationwide. And it's pieces of our immigration law that say you can't discriminate against people based on their nation of origin or their religion. So he's looking at those specific provisions and saying discrimination is not allowed, and are people getting due process? So on a couple of fronts, that's where the challenge is coming from. He's also was joined at the press conference, Bob Ferguson, by tech employers here. Amazon and Expedia are filing pieces of this or adding information about how this law is affecting them, how it's affecting their workers. AG Ferguson said that his team worked through the weekend to get this brief filed and get this brief ready. The lawsuit is supposed to be filed this afternoon in federal court. And again, it will have broad implications. And it's the first in the nation to challenge this part of the executive order.
We're going to get more into the tech company effect later in this hour, in about half hour from now. What else are opponents of Trump's move doing about it?
Yeah, well, you've probably seen a lot of protests happening around the country here in Seattle as well. One of the first ones started Saturday at SeaTac as word started to come around. The order went into effect Friday. Word started catching on early Saturday morning that people were being detained at airports. I arrived at SeaTac early afternoon. There was one protester there. He was a college student from Burien holding a sign quietly by the international arrivals. By the end of the day, port officials estimated 3,000 people had turned out at SeaTac to show a sign of support against this executive order and say they support refugees and immigrants coming here. There was another protest last night at Westlake Center, downtown Seattle. Thousands were reportedly there. There is that Seattle City Council today, Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez is introducing a resolution to say we support refugees and immigrants. On that Facebook page, nearly 10,000 people have showed they're interested in going. About 1,000 say they will be there. So that's one happening today. on another front, excuse me, lawyers are at SeaTac staffing the airport around the clock just to kind of watchdog the situation, make sure that things continue to flow smoothly. We've heard from Department of Homeland Security and White House officials about green card holders. So this was particular concern about green card holders who have been cleared to come and go from the U.S. freely.
Those are legal permanent residents.
Legal permanent residents on their way to become citizens here. So they've gone through levels of clearance already to get to that point. So there was concern that they were being stopped and detained and not being let through customs here. That's why the attorneys are there watching that to make sure that process continues to flow. And we heard from one attorney there this morning who is just keeping an eye on that situation.
At this point, it's fair to say that we have optimistic signals that CBP is going to be following normal inspection procedures for green card holders from the affected countries. So it looks optimistic that they will be allowed in.
But this is happening at airports still around the country. Thousands of lawyers, volunteer lawyers, are on hand for family members that are concerned about their loved ones coming in and being let in the doors here. On the congressional front, we've heard from probably all of our Congress members here in Washington State about this. It's pretty much falls down on both sides of the aisle there from our Democratic lawmakers. Several of them spoke to press this weekend at SeaTac Airport. We heard from Representative Pramila Jayapal, Representative Susan DelBene, from Senator Murray.
Patty Murray.
Mm-hmm. And I was at one of the press conferences, and it was just palpable in the room how livid they were. Some, like, almost physically shaking, and the words that they used were really quite angry. On the Republican side, we've heard a more measured response, mostly support for what the president's action is doing, but saying that they want to see compassion for these people that are seeking safety here. So seeing both sides of that. But from our lawmakers here, I think they were mostly upset that it was, I mean, one of the reasons they were very upset was that it came down so quickly, very chaotically. There was very little communication about logistics on the ground. We heard of at least one person being deported out of SeaTac Airport, a refugee being deported back to Europe who was originally from Somalia.
KUOW immigration reporter Liz Jones, that's all the time we have for right now. We look forward to your continuing coverage. Our immigration team will learn more about these families, check back in with them, and try to figure out what's next for them. Thank you, Liz.
You're welcome.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. President Donald Trump is publicly confident. Let's hope he's privately humble. Oh, and you should be humble, too. So says best-selling author Michael Lewis. His latest book, The Undoing Project, is the true story of two psychologists who taught us to doubt our powers of decision. Michael Lewis, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
Now, you didn't write about the election in this book, but you did write that decision makers should know what they don't know, right?
Yes. And the project that Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky are engaged in is asking, like, what are people doing when they're making decisions and judgments? What's going on in the minds of people doing these things? They aren't, as economists at the time assumed, like really good intuitive statisticians who are calculating the odds of everything around them as they're making the decisions. What they are is storytellers and really good at pattern recognition.
That's the human animal, is a storytelling beast.
Storytelling beast. And they're looking for patterns and finding meaning in patterns even when the meaning isn't there. They are, after the fact, constructing narratives to make things seem much more predictable than they are. They're doing lots of things to eliminate uncertainty and eliminate doubt.
Even when uncertainty is just the way it is.
Well, uncertainty, as they would point out and did over and over, is actually kind of the intelligent way to approach the world, with a sense of uncertainty, a sense that it's a probabilistic matter, most things. And the judgments you make are often inherently fallible. So their work was a kind of paean to doubt. And it's interesting that we have now elected a president who completely trusts his gut.
At least publicly, he seems to.
Oh, I think that's him.
Yeah.
I think that's him. He's not like Shrek, where there are layers and layers and layers. No, I think what you see is what you get. And he's very wedded to his infallibility, to the point where whenever there's a mistake, he changes things afterwards, so it wasn't a mistake. I mean, I didn't write this The Undoing Project to describe the election or Donald Trump, but Kahneman and Tversky have created this very interesting lens to view him through.
We'll talk a little more about the election and other stuff. Would you sum up the work these two that you've discussed, one of these psychologists would win the Nobel Prize? They seem to say that you have your gut feeling and then you invent reasons to bolster that feeling, things like that over and over and over. What's the work they did in a nutshell?
So what they did is they sat in a room and they tossed around the mistakes that they themselves found themselves making as they moved through the world. And their material they drew on was from, a lot of it was from their time in the Israeli army. And they would have these insights. So for example, one insight they had was the way their judgment was often distorted by a completely irrelevant piece of information introduced into the scenario. So in this case, they built a wheel of fortune with 100 numbers on the Wheel of Fortune. They brought subjects into their lab. The subjects would be asked to spin the Wheel of Fortune, and it would land on some number randomly. And then they would ask the subjects, what percentage of the countries in the United Nations come from Africa? And the subjects that spun a high number on the Wheel of Fortune estimated a higher number of countries in the United Nations from Africa than the subjects who spent a low number. They had a name for this. They called it anchoring. And they showed how people could be anchored in making a judgment by just throwing out a number.
And businesses use that because they throw out a high number and you'll spend a little more toward that high number.
Or plaintiff attorneys use it, right? You would think that offering a wholly preposterous number at which you're owed for whatever happened to you would not help you. In fact, it drags the ultimate settlement up from where it would have otherwise been. You know, it got formalized into a body of thinking called judgment and decision making inside of psychology. It created the field of behavioral economics. It gave real energy to evidence-based medicine. But what their work really was just like two guys sitting in a room thinking about the funny things people do. And they found ways to test them that were scientifically credible and sold the world on them.
And yet, how could that be surprising? Everybody knows that to err is human.
This is true. So when you just say, oh, what do these two guys do? They show that people are irrational. That's not that interesting.
Right.
Because everybody but economists knew that people were irrational.
Right.
Even economists knew that they were irrational. But what the thinking was when they enter the scene is that the irrationality is, it's not systematic. It's a product of a mood or an emotion or, you know, not everybody's perfectly rational. What they showed was everybody's minds are wired to make the same kinds of mistakes. We're systematically irrational. And if that's so, then whole markets can be wrong. Election markets can be wrong. It's a bigger deal.
Do you have any examples of what those systematic ways that over and over and over were going to be wrong?
This is the story of their collaboration. They showed how people think in stereotypes. And a manifestation of this is, I don't know, if you go into a basketball general manager's front office in the NBA, the people who are evaluating the basketball players are constantly at risk of overvaluing a player who physically resembles a really good player who happens to be in the NBA, an amateur player. Since Steph Curry arrived on the scene and created a kind of a new model for what a great NBA player could look like, light-skinned black guy who's short and stays on the outside. You know, he doesn't look like what great NBA players look like. Since then, though, every year there's some kid from a college who has been overvalued because he looks physically like Steph Curry. The most recent one was from Washington. This book I wrote about baseball, Moneyball, the baseball scouts have this problem over and over. They like people who look like players they have known before. That's a kind of a systematic problem people have.
Michael Lewis is the author of Moneyball, got turned into a movie you may have heard about, and his latest book is sort of a prequel. It's like all the whys. Why would baseball executives make such poor decisions? Well, now in your new book, The Undoing Project, you're getting at that. By the way, that title, The Undoing Project, comes from something that Seahawks fans will be familiar with. The Seahawks would have won that Super Bowl if only we could have undone the final play of the game. What is undoing?
Sure. Well, the Undoing Project broadly, I thought, was a fairly accurate description of what Kahneman and Tversky were up to in their dozen years working together. They were undoing a false view of man and man's mind. But there was something else, too, that when they broke up, and they did break up. They had basically a romance. They were in love with each other.
Right.
It had ended stormily. And when they were breaking up, Kahneman had this idea that they should explore the rules of the imagination, that the way people created alternative realities in their minds wasn't just free-floating. The human imagination wasn't just kind of like making anything up. Hmm. There was this kind of grammar to it. And he gets this idea after he watches the response to the death of his nephew. His nephew's a fighter pilot in the Israeli army. He survived wars, dogfights, all the rest. And 2 days before he's due to be released from the Air Force, he's blinded by a flare and gets disoriented. And sometimes I gather in fighter jets, you can think you're going up when you're going down. You lose your sense of direction. And he flew his plane directly into the ground and it exploded. And Kahneman went back to the funeral. He was watching all the people mourning. And there were a lot of people talking about, you know, if only he had gotten out 2 days earlier, or if only the flare hadn't gone up, or if only they hadn't been that place at that time. And Danny's response, as very Danny Kahneman, was not to like become engaged in the grief with everybody else. He watched everybody else's grief. And he said, you know, nobody says, if only there wasn't an Israeli Air Force. There are lots of ways you could have avoided this accident. And minds are drifting in a certain direction. So he started to lay out what people did when they did these things. And the first point he makes is that, you know, when you try to undo something, you start at the event, and then it's the end of a long causal chain, and you work backwards in time. And the first thing you can undo to undo the result, your mind undoes. So in the most recent election, if you're distressed that Trump won, you are very focused on Comey and Congress, on the FBI directors raising Hillary's emails as a subject at the end of the campaign.
Yeah, that was Russell Wilson throwing the interception at the end if you're
exactly
if
right.
You're a liberal.
It's all the same thing. That why field goal kickers who miss the field goal kick at the end of the game ostracized. There are many, many things that happen in the middle of the game. Some offensive lineman probably got a penalty in the first quarter that may have cost them more points. And the field goal kicker would never have been put in that position, but people don't focus on that.
And the point of all this, I take it, is that if we understood our decision-making better, we could do a better job at getting the things in life that we want, right?
Well, this is true. And I also, it's sane making to know what your mind is doing when it's doing irrational things, even if it's going to do them anyway. I find that you can filter much of life through their work, because much of life is just making decisions and judgments. You don't realize how many you're making during the day. An example, you're driving down the highway and you're usually speeding 3 or 4 miles an hour and you see a grisly accident. For the next hour or two, you drive 10 miles an hour slower. Why is that? You've made a judgment. You've seen the accident. You've made a judgment that the probability of an accident is higher than you thought it was, and so you're going to be more cautious. Then you forget. They point out that memory is a huge contributor to the distortions in people's judgment. What just happened,
yep,
or what's vivid,
yep,
is exaggerated in its importance.
Yes.
And happens over and over and over again. We're always responding to whatever just happened unintelligently rather than responding to what is likely to happen. We mistake the first for the second. And it's just, we're wired to do certain things. And this is what they were pointing out. We are wired to do these things.
And how can we use that insight to act differently and get better outcomes?
Well, in that case, you probably drive slower all the time.
But rats!
But you know, it's funny. They're all, the how-to aspect of their work is an interesting and problematic exercise, because they themselves were very skeptical of people's ability, even when they were taught the mistakes their minds made, their ability to correct for them. One thing they agreed upon in kind of like how to use this work is that you have to be very sensitive to your decision-making environment. You may not see the errors you're making, but it's easier for someone else to see them. So if you build checks into your environment, you're safer.
That's why I began this conversation with a president who you think is not surrounding himself with checks and balances and outside opinions.
President Trump is really Kahneman and Tversky's nightmare, because one, he does not seem to be all that interested in checks on his own thinking. But two, because he's so trusting of his intuitive judgment, and they've shown the way intuitive judgment can be manipulated, he will be unusually susceptible to manipulation by the people around him, which sounds strange, right? Because you think of him as the strong man. In fact, you just know the people around him know how to pull his strings. So you got to watch that, you know, you got to watch that. Contrast that with Obama. It's a very interesting contrast.
Who you spent a lot of time with.
A lot of time with. And he really was very sensitive to the effects of his environment on his decisions, to the point where he had read research that showed that the more decisions you make, the more it degrades your ability to make decisions. So you have to eliminate all kinds of trivial decisions if you've got to make big ones or you want to make them well. So he had eliminated all his clothing except his blue and his gray suit. So he didn't have to think about what he was wearing it every day.
I read that, and it might have been from you. It's Friday as we tape this conversation. I've worn these pants every single day this week because that stuck with me. Yeah, why do I have to make this up every time? I got to get to work. I don't want to stare at the closet. I got other things to think about.
Well, so this did come from me in this piece I wrote about him. And, you know, he didn't choose his meals. It was all set. It was all the trivial stuff he took off the table because he knew it was going to affect the non-trivial stuff. And he also knew that in any room where he's making a decision, the people who are advising him, one, have their own biases, and they may not even be aware of them. And so you need to kind of check those, but try to have offsetting things. And two, that the moment people knew what he thought, it distorted the decision-making environment because they want to please the president.
Sure.
And so he was always very guarded about showing what he, you know, are we going to bomb Libya? He didn't want anybody to know in advance what his predisposition was in the room.
That seems so wise.
It's very wise. And what we have is gone from a very wise decision-making environment to a very unwise one, which doesn't mean that Trump's decisions in the end are going to be worse than Obama's. In the long run, they will, but he could get lucky. You know, it's sort of like if you go into the casino and you've got two people at the blackjack table, one of whom is a really good card counter who's counting the cards, and the other who's filled up with booze and is just sure he's going to get lucky. It's possible the guy who's filled with booze and sure he's going to get lucky, he's going to win in short streaks. So he may get lucky. But we've just moved the odds against us a little bit, and maybe a lot.
We're talking with Michael Lewis, and his latest book is called The Undoing Project, about how we make decisions, whether we think we're good at it or not. You are part of a wave of bestsellers about decision-making. We were talking about this. Dan Ariely with Predictably Irrational. Catherine Schultz wrote Being Wrong. Malcolm Gladwell, Steven Pinker, David Brooks, your man Daniel Kahneman, have recently sold some books about this. Do you think we've made a real change in how we see ourselves?
Well, I mean, the Obama presidency is a total tribute to that. We've never had a president who was so aware of the fallibility of his own fallibility and tried to correct for it. Inherent fallibility, not that he was weaker than everybody else. It was just that's the way people are.
Is he reading this new work?
Absolutely. When I met him, so this was 4.5 years ago, he had on his desk Danny Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. Here's the big drift in the culture, and which is at odds with what's going on in the White House right now, but more generally in leadership. I think it's becoming more and more acceptable to exhibit a bit of uncertainty, that there is a long history of leaders winning the confidence of the people they're leading by seeming more confident than they actually are. And it's sort of like a rule. You've got to seem more confident than you actually are. People are learning that that's not very intelligent, that actually we want whoever's making the decision to understand he's in a probabilistic universe and that he needs to understand that he can't think he can always pick right. It's not as simple as that. So I think we're internalizing it, that the findings of psychology are finding their way into the culture, but it's by fits and starts.
My kids' school teaches them about mindfulness, which is a kind of not taking your first instinct and your thoughts, the noise in your head, too seriously.
So here's another example of how the culture drifted. I mean, you're right when you say this book is the prequel to Moneyball. That is what it is. It is the description of what's going on inside the minds of baseball scouts who screw up the valuation of baseball players to the extent that the Oakland A's, with no money, can come in and buy up cheap baseball players and win. Oakland A's can't do that anymore because the whole market has moved in their direction. You've got people moneyballing this and moneyballing that the whole market has come to understand that you are better off with statistics and data than you are with the intuitive judgment of some putative expert. And that's happened in many, many spheres. It happened in medicine a while ago, but what's going on in medicine, I think, is amazing. I mean, you've got people at MD Anderson trying to move the diagnosis of cancer into the machine, away from the doctor. You've got in politics, these political campaigns, even the Trump campaign, was heavily invested in statistical analysis of voters. Yeah.
Hmm.
Jared Kushner, his name, gave a big interview about how they'd moneyballed the election.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Michael Lewis.
I think the Clinton campaign was doing the same stuff. It's a question of who was doing it better. She still did win by almost 3 million votes. She just didn't win. Anyway, so you do see the culture moving. I think you don't see the culture completely understanding why it's moving all the time. But yes, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky have had an enormous influence on the world around them.
Finally, I know that Tversky and Kahneman were humble about saying, and here's what to do about it. You can change your life. It's not a self-help thing. Then what can I do? So I am an error machine, my brain. What can the listener listening to you do differently?
So what I said to you about thinking about the environment, allowing checks on your decision-making, find ways to check yourself. Doctors do this all the time. When you ever go into the hospital for any kind of procedure, you notice how they're doing things over and over, like three or four times? You asked me that question already. You know, you feel that way with them all.
Yes.
But a different person comes in and asks you the same question. That's what they're doing. They're trying to avoid the kind of mistakes that one person acting alone on where they're using their judgment makes.
Oh, I thought they just didn't know what the other hand was doing.
No, that's not true.
Good for the hospitals.
Yes. Yeah. So Danny Kahneman trained Israeli fighter pilots. He was training the instructors of Israeli fighter pilots. And he noticed when he was training them that they relied very heavily on criticism, not praise. And they actually told him that the praise doesn't work when you're teaching people. Criticism works. And he said, well, why is that? They said, whenever we're working with a pilot and he does something extremely good compared to what he usually does and we praise him for it, he's bad the next time. And whenever we're working with a pilot and he does something really, really bad and we criticize him, he gets better the next time.
Sounds fair. Sounds reasonable.
Right. And so they had grown to believe that the praise was useless and you lean on these guys. You're just negative, negative, negative. And Danny said, no, actually what you're seeing there is an illusion. It's called regression to the mean, that whenever anybody does anything better than usual, the next thing they're going to do in any task is likely going to be a little worse.
Uh-huh.
And whenever anybody does anything much worse than usual, the next thing they're going to do is a little better. So the world is sending you a signal to be negative in the way you teach and coach and parent. And when I learned that, I have adjusted. I coach all my kids. I obviously teach my kids when I can. I'm in various teaching roles. I adjust. I lean against, in my mind, against the temptation to be negative and critical and lean towards being positive and praising because I know the world's trying to trick me into being the other way.
This is my kids' favorite interview of the year, I'm sure. When they hear this, they're Michael Lewis fans for life. Michael Lewis is author of the book The Undoing Project, and it's great to see you. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You and your neighbors can add to the conversations we're having here. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Before Seattle Times reporter Claudia Rowe moved out here, she was living in Poughkeepsie in New York, where in 1996, women began to disappear. These women had worked as prostitutes, and they had all reported a man named Kendall Francois to the police for sexual assault, for beating them, for choking them. In 1998, Francois was finally arrested, and inside the home he shared with his family were found the bodies of eight women. After Francois was taken into custody, Claudia Rowe drove to that house, and she sat out front, and she kept thinking something she couldn't shake.
It was this sweltering hot day at the very beginning of September 1998, very humid, thick air, and yet I was shivering. And I looked up at that house, and I didn't quite know, of course, what was all going to happen, but I thought, this story is going to change your life. This story means something about you. I felt it right then, and I didn't know how to explain it.
You had no inkling of how the story was going to change your life or how it was you at that moment, just that it was.
There was something about a family. Obviously, this was a family home, and it was clear that something had really gone off the rails in this family, obviously, since there were eight bodies in their home. And I could see that. Obviously, what had gone on inside of that home was very different from the way it presented on the outside. And I suspect that that is what resonated with me, because that was true of my own home growing up as well. certainly not to the scale in any way of Kendall Francois' life and family, but I had my own ghosts and demons about denial and about the way we present on the outside not being at all reflective of what's going on behind closed doors.
You had your own ghosts and demons, which at that point you hadn't really thought about that much or reflected on that much, but what were those ghosts and demons?
The ghosts and demons had to do with a domestic situation that was extremely volatile and, most of all, extremely unpredictable. And I think that unpredictability was what I really carried with me, and what that sense of nothing is secure and nothing is reliable, you can't depend on anything. I think that is what initially propelled me toward looking at crime, the sense of trying to be ready for anything, understanding that the world could change on a dime and you don't really know who's standing right next to you or sitting behind you, and trying to be, as the psychological community would say, sort of hypervigilant. I wasn't really trying to be, I just was hypervigilant because of growing up in a situation where anything might happen at any moment. It was very unpredictable.
So, as you said, you had these ghosts and demons from your own childhood haunting you. You had this really strong sense that this story of this man who had killed eight women, hid them in his house where his family lived, that story was going to change your life. It connected to you in some way. What did you do with all of that? What was your next course of action?
A frantic and almost addictive compulsion to keep looking deeper. So I began to read sort of very academic texts about psychopathology and serial murder. I read everything from these very dry case studies to the trashiest books and everything in between. I knew I was looking for something. I wasn't quite sure what I was looking for.
So at what point did you decide you needed to go directly to Kendall Francois to try and answer some of these questions?
I decided that I thought maybe he could somehow explain to me or show me the mechanism behind cruelty. I didn't really think he would say, this happened to me and then I did this, you know, like an algebraic equation. I didn't really imagine it would be that clean. But I thought that maybe he would be able to put the pieces together for me. And in somehow understanding the roots of his rage, I might be able to kind of divine like a parallel of the rage that had propelled people in my own life and in my own past. And that's really what I wanted. It was this intense hunger to understand that as a way to leech some of the pain out of it.
I'm talking with Claudia Rowe. She's a reporter for the Seattle Times, and she's also written a new book. It's called The Spider and the Fly, and it's about her time in Poughkeepsie, New York, where she worked as a stringer for the New York Times, the time she spent writing a man named Kendall Francois while he was in prison for murdering eight women. It's also about her. And at what point did you decide that you were done corresponding with Kendall Francois?
Well, I don't want to give away too much from the end of the book, but there came a point where I've gotten what I need to get from this relationship and what I can get from it. Now it's time to take care of myself and take care of my own life, which had largely disintegrated by that point. Everything outside of the correspondence with Kendall Francois was rotting away. And I felt that I had reached a point of knowledge and needed to start to protect myself more.
And part of that protection was crossing the country. You came here to the Northwest.
I did. Seattle saved my life in many ways. I didn't know that it would. In fact, when I came here, I thought I would just sublet a place for a few months, finish up this troublesome book, and go on with my life, though I didn't really know what that would be. What happened was that I sent some clips, New York Times stuff, to the Seattle PI, the former Post Intelligencer, which no longer exists, thinking that I would just do a little freelance work to support myself while I was muddling through this monstrosity of a book. And the PI said, well, why don't you just come here and cover social issues for us full time as a reporter, and I was only too grateful to have an excuse. And that's what happened. I stepped away from the book for 8 years while I worked at the PI and became a much more seasoned journalist and learned how to have more confidence and trust in my perceptions. That was something that had been very shaky for me my whole life, and something that the interaction with Kendall Francois constantly undermined. I had all these thoughts and perceptions, but I questioned myself endlessly. And in finding a place at the PI, a place where people trusted my vision and believed in me, it really changed me, and it made me a better reporter, probably a better person too.
There was another piece to wanting a distraction from the troublesome book, as you called it, trying to write about Kendall Francois. And that was that every time you sat down to write about Kendall Francois, you ended up writing about yourself.
Right. My idea for this book was very traditional at first. I was a journalist and I was going to approach this story as a journalist. I was going to write a straight story about how could this city have birthed this person and how could this person be created? You know, very straight kind of A plus B equals C kind of journalistic answers. That's what I wanted at first and that's what I thought I was going to write. But every time I sat down to write, stuff from my own past kept coming out. And I'm like, no, I don't want to write a memoir. No, I'm not doing that. But it kept coming out. And then when I would talk with people about this book and they would ask about it, all they ever really wanted to know was, well, why are you doing it? Who are you that you would be doing this? What is drawing you? That's what people were interested in. Despite my fascination with him, the outside world was interested in why was I doing this? And I had to hear that and understand it and then kind of honor what was happening with me in the writing process, which was clearly, I had to admit, this story was absolutely personal. And while it may have begun nominally out of sort of journalistic impulses, I had to be real about how personal it was to me and be honest about that with a reader.
So we started this conversation with this thought that you had the night Kendall Francois was arrested. This story is you. Meaning about you, Claudia. Were you right? Was this story you?
Yeah. This story turned out to be my Waterloo. This story turned out to be a crucible I had to go through to change my understanding of family and to learn a kind of compassion for ugliness. And I think what I came out of it with was a sense that all of us really need to look deeper and with more compassion at those things that repel us. I think that people probably looked at me at various points in my own life as very perplexing and troubling and then looked away. I was a pretty troubling teenager, for sure. I had a similar reaction to the women on the street in Poughkeepsie who were Kendall's victims. I saw street walkers all the time and was repelled initially by what I saw. And how could you do that? And how could you let yourself be there? And same for him, obviously, this monstrous person who did this horrible, horrible, unforgivable things. The natural impulse is to look away or to find a place for blame. It's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. And I think through doing this book, I learned that blame kind of cuts off the conversation. It's not that there aren't people or forces to blame. Surely there are. But it's a very limiting kind of exercise to find your place for blame. It might be momentarily satisfying, but it doesn't get any of us any farther.
You talked about the process of getting to know Kendall Francois and then the process of writing this book, which was much longer than your actual relationship with Kendall Francois, as a crucible. The whole thing was a crucible. So now that you've been through that crucible, who are you? How did it change you?
I think it made me a much more sensitive reporter, a reporter much more attuned to gray areas. I think we are all living in gray areas. And it made me understand that within so-called evil, there are threads of recognizable humanity. And within so-called good people, there is a capability for great cruelty and harm. And we are all of us on a spectrum, a continuum of sort of humanity. And it left me able to hear stories that are not clean and that have many, many gray areas. And I think that is a much truer way to get at the truth, to be real about the gray areas within all of us.
That's Claudia Rowe, an education reporter for the Seattle Times Now, and she told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel there about her new book, which is called The Spider and the Fly. More of KUOW's The Record coming up. Now, earlier in this program, we heard from someone who's pretty powerless, a Tukwila family of Syrian refugees who are now separated from their pregnant daughter. Now let's turn to the powerful. Amazon, Expedia, Microsoft, Google are in different ways opposing the president's executive order on the halting of the Syrian refugee program, the temporary suspension of immigration from 7 majority Muslim countries. Here to talk about it from Seattle's tech news site GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Hello.
Hi, Bill.
How are these companies? Let's start with, they keep coming. So today's news, I guess, is Amazon and Expedia sort of supporting a Washington state lawsuit?
That's right. So today, as I know you've reported, the Washington State Attorney General gave notice of the intent to file suit against Trump, and Amazon and Expedia have both signed on to that lawsuit, essentially, and offered declarations of support for it based on the impact on their businesses.
And what are they saying?
So in each case, these companies rely heavily on international groups of engineers. In some cases, these engineers come from overseas on things like an H-1B visa. In other cases, they're working and they might be traveling for Expedia or Amazon or Microsoft and need to come in and out of the country. And they might be originally citizens of other countries here on green cards. And so in all these cases, what these companies say is that they need this talent from outside of the country because there's not enough engineers here to employ in the jobs that Microsoft and Amazon and Expedia need. Now, I have to say, this has been a bone of contention over the years with labor leaders and domestic engineers. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, wait a second. I applied for that job and I didn't get it, and somebody else got that job through an H-1B visa. So in a lot of ways, what Trump is doing here and potentially could do on the H-1B visa program could be supported by workers in the U.S.
Right. Microsoft said last night, we believe the executive order is misguided and a fundamental step backwards. There are more effective ways to protect public safety without creating so much collateral damage to the country's reputation and values. Did you see the Google, what do they call it, the doodle?
Yes.
Today with a sort of resistor from back in the days of Japanese-American internment during World War II.
That's right. And on that Microsoft statement, it was interesting. They originally put out a slightly weaker statement than that. It was much stronger that they put out last night. Mm. And they were called out by the tech news site The Verge as having a weak response to Trump. And then Microsoft came out Sunday night with that much stronger statement. So you can see how these companies that might have actually been okay going along with Trump at the beginning, and there were some conciliatory statements after his election,
mm-hmm.
are now saying, okay, now that they see what's going on, the gloves are coming off a bit.
So how much power do these tech companies have? Who's more powerful, a president or giant multinational zillionaire tech companies?
That's a great question. If you're talking about the power to influence Trump himself at this point, I think very few companies have that. And if anything, Trump has been looking to more traditional manufacturing companies, automakers, to make a statement about the jobs that he's creating here or keeping here. But if you look at a company like Amazon, they just announced they're going to be hiring and expanding by 100,000 people in the U.S. over the next 18 months. That seems like that should be a powerful statement that somebody who's leading the country should pay attention to if you're creating that kind of job growth. So yeah, I guess it all depends on whether there's some rational thought happening here.
And it's curious to know whether the president's administration is looking at swing states, you know, what companies in what state. We just don't know.
Yeah. Is this the election or is it the governing at this point? I think that's another big question.
You mentioned the president seems interested in worker visas, and he's not signed an executive order on this subject, right? But it might be coming?
That's right. There's a report out from Bloomberg News today saying that he is actually looking at revamping the H-1B visa program. This is a program used by Microsoft, Amazon, many other tech companies to bring in tens of thousands of workers internationally each year. And the report from Bloomberg says that Trump would require these companies to try and hire Americans first. And then if they feel that they have to go internationally, priority would be given to the highest paid positions to get these H-1B visas.
Why the highest paid positions?
Beats me. Huh. I guess maybe because those are considered the most valuable to the economy. Mm. That would be very different from the way they do it now, which is essentially a lottery. There's a certain number of H-1B visas allotted each year, and the companies basically bid for them and try to get them for their workers.
Well, I surely don't know how tech company hiring works. It sounds like it's a bit vague that it could be up to the companies to tell you whether we searched adequately here in this country or that country.
It would be interesting to see how they create that kind of litmus test to determine whether they could go for H-1B visas. As with a lot of this stuff, even once we get the executive order on H-1Bs, it may not be clear.
Mm. So we have about a minute left. Anything else we ought to know for now, Todd Bishop, about the state of tech companies in this new administration?
To me, it's been fascinating to see, in particular, Expedia's CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, come out and talk about this. He immigrated from Iran in the 1970s with his family after the Iranian Revolution, and he came out very strongly against Trump's action. And to me, that's a bit of a litmus test because this is a company that relies heavily not only on engineers internationally, but on global travel, Expedia, obviously.
Yeah.
And this is really a case where these tech execs are taking a stand in many ways.
That is Todd Bishop, co-founder of Seattle's tech news site GeekWire. We'll stay in touch, Todd. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.